This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Nathan Sanders.
Explosive diarrhea has been topping the news for weeks. The Cyclospora outbreak has sickened more than 1,600 Americans. The upper Midwest has been especially hard hit, but dozens of Texans are among those sickened by the parasite. Angela Walla is a Texas Tech professor in the Department of Animal and Food Sciences, which is part of the Davis College of Agricultural Sciences and Natural Resources. She joins us by Zoom. Angela, what's the latest on this outbreak from a Texas perspective? How many Texans have gotten sick, and where in Texas have these cases popped up?
Well, that's the thing with Cyclospora and parasites. We don't have the latest numbers of where we are, because it does take some time for our Department of Health to come up with our latest numbers. We're probably close to maybe 100 cases in Texas, but those numbers change every day. The way our health care system works is, as soon as they're reported, then they have to go through the portal to be able to be reported to our Department of Agriculture to get those updated numbers. So it does typically take, with an outbreak, 2 to 3 months after the outbreak before we have a realistic understanding of the breadth of what happened.
This outbreak has been quite a bit larger than others. A 2020 outbreak sickened about 700 people, and a string of outbreaks between 2013 and 2015 all affected fewer than 700. Why has this one produced so many more cases?
Well, we don't know why it has produced so many more cases, but you know, the fact that it's being linked to lettuce and leafy greens, it's a really good thing for us. We're being more health conscious. We're eating a lot more produce, which is a good thing for Americans. We want them to be eating a lot of produce, but that could be why we are seeing a higher spike in the number of people affected by it, because it's been related to our salads and leafy greens. And that has really been where we've been really emphasizing Americans to eat more greens.
How do you think the response has been? Are officials doing what they need to do?
I believe they're doing what they need to do. So the thing about Cyclospora is it takes between 1 to 2 weeks before you see these explosive diarrhea. So when they are interviewing people who have symptoms and have been diagnosed, they're asking them, what did you eat a week or two ago? Everything, what did you eat? Where did you eat at? What brands? And so it could be challenging for, I think of myself, to even remember what I ate 2 days ago. So it makes it extra challenging. So they have to put together kind of a puzzle of, where did everybody eat? What products did they eat? Where did they eat at? And with that timeline of 1 to 2 weeks, and say, what are the commonalities? So it takes time for them to be able to navigate and to see if it's one product, two products, three products associated with it. So they're working really hard to identify the specific companies that are involved, as well as the specific farms. It's a lot of legwork. The consumers really need to have confidence right now that FDA and the produce industry is doing the best right now to identify the cause. Mm-hmm. They should feel very confident that they are releasing information as soon as they have it. They're updating and pulling products. We have a lot of companies that are volunteering, pulling products while they get their results of, are they part of this outbreak? So people should really have confidence with what's happening within our government trying to resolve this. So I think that's a big take-home message. Another thing that I'm hearing a lot about is people saying, oh, it only affects conventional products. It doesn't affect organics. Organic products. And that's not true. Cyclospora, like E. coli, Salmonella, Listeria, does not know the difference between one product or the other. So people should just continue to buy what they're buying, rinse it off, or choose to have a cooked option if you're concerned. So those are the big things I would say.
There's been a lot of discussion about how to keep yourself safe. Is washing produce good enough? I mean, should people use the sprays that are being sold? Does produce need to be cooked before it's eaten?
So the biggest thing we always say is it's a parasite. So the oocytes that it produces are what we like to rinse off. So we're recommending that both if you're going to eat fresh vegetables, please rinse them, and that will get rid of the oocytes. But then also think towards our frozen varieties of vegetables as well as cooking. So I think in our family, we're still eating lettuce, we're still eating our leafy greens, but we're also eating a lot of cabbage and spinach where we're just doing a light saute of them as well, because I do have younger children. But we are rinsing everything. So right now, rinsing is the best. All those products aren't going to be like a bacteria. So like E. coli, Salmonella, Listeria are able to be killed by a sanitizer, but with a parasite, there's no killing, or it's not the same mechanism of death.
That kind of leads me to my next question. It being summer, a lot of people really like the lighter options like salad, but is simply avoiding the fruits and vegetables that have been identified with this outbreak the best approach?
Well, that's the thing. We really don't have a clear list of which specific products we're going back and forth. There's not a confirmed case. If you didn't see yesterday, FDA did have a false positive, which is common with Cyclospora. It's very hard to detect with Taylor Farms. And so Taylor Farms did a voluntary recall, and that's good practice for them to have. So what I would say is continue to eat your leafy greens. If you are wanting to be more cautious, then go towards things that are cooked in that, or just rinsing them very well before you have your salad.
And then, if someone does experience the symptoms that are linked to cyclosporiasis, how serious is it? Should they see a doctor right away? And it can't be spread between humans, correct?
So the oocytes can be spread if you are not washing your hands and somebody else eats that product. So I'm just going to leave it like that. What I would say is the major thing with Cyclospora and the fact that you develop frequent diarrhea is dehydration. And that's the main concern when the after effect of Cyclospora. So if you are a high-risk person, I always say seek care for if you have the explosive diarrhea. It also will help with us understanding better of the breadth of this outbreak that's happening and provide more data in there. And telling your doctor, I've been eating, I'm a leafy green eater. I eat a lot of vegetables, and be ready to answer that question of what did you eat for the past couple weeks to help towards finding a causation for this outbreak.
Angela Walla is a microbiologist and food scientist in the Department of Animal and Food Sciences at Texas Tech University. Angela, thank you so much for joining the West Texas Dispatch.
Thank you.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. Last month, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department announced that Lake Meredith near Amarillo was designated as, quote, fully infested with invasive zebra mussels. The mussels have been spreading across Texas for more than 15 years, and Lake Meredith is the northernmost body of water in the state to be infected. KTTZ's Samantha Larned reports the mussels have the potential to damage treatment equipment in what is a municipal water source for the region.
Monica McGarity is the senior scientist for aquatic invasive species with Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. She works to coordinate between agencies, states, and regions to provide guidance on invasive species. McGarity explains that in this case, infested means the mussels are fully established and reproducing in the lake. Zebra mussel larvae are microscopic and free-floating in water, while adult zebra mussels can survive outside of water for up to a month.
Typically, the populations in our Texas lakes tend to kind of take off within the first 1 to 3 years and rapidly increase.
The first infestation in Texas was found in Lake Texoma in 2009, according to TPWD. Since then, invasive mussels have been identified in 40 lakes in Texas, and 35 have been declared fully infested. The department says that the population in Lake Meredith is likely dispersed throughout the reservoir, and McGarity says it could be a, quote, stepping stone to other western states.
This is important because not only is it a very long distance movement that puts nearby lakes at risk, it's a new river basin, and it also is close to I-40, which is a corridor heading west.
McGarity explains that one of the main concerns with zebra mussels is how they attach and damage infrastructure.
The zebra mussels can attach. They can attach to each other and form colonies that could be clogging, damaging to pipes and infrastructure. So one of the main reasons why we work with a lot of partners on early detection is to try to give operators of any water treatment facilities or any facilities using raw surface water advance notice so they can start mitigation.
Along with being a recreation site, Lake Meredith is part of the Canadian River Municipal Water Authority, or CRMWA, which provides water to 11 cities, including Lubbock.
The CRMWA has indicated to us that they've been very proactive with already starting on prevention mitigation strategies, and they'll be shifting their focus more towards that. Finding these as early as possible helps to make sure that those impacts are limited.
Chad Purnell, deputy director of CRMWA, says the authority has been testing for zebra mussels multiple times a year since they first entered the state. At this stage, he says he's not overly concerned about the impact on cities that utilize the lake's water.
Over time, there have been ways that have been developed to treat zebra mussels and to mitigate the effect that they can have on our system.
Current efforts include using a chemical treatment frequently utilized in reservoirs to control the zebra mussel population. In other cases, Purnell says some coatings can be put on infrastructures to keep mussels from sticking, but those have not been implemented yet. CRMWA will continue looking into new developments and learning from other systems that have dealt with invasive mussels. Those visiting the lake can also help prevent the further spread of zebra mussels. TPWD requires that boaters clean, drain, and dry their crafts and equipment between visits to different bodies of water.
When you're coming to Lake Meredith, make sure you've cleaned, drained, and dried after leaving the previous lake you visited. You might be bringing an invasive plant that's not present in the lake already. When you leave the lake, make sure you clean, drain, and dry before you go to another water body for the same reason.
McGarity says that for a boat that's only been in the water for a few days, the concern is not mussels attaching to the vessel itself, but to mud or plants that may be on the boat. Meanwhile, invisible larvae may be present in water stuck in the boat.
Go ahead and drain all the water out of all the compartments. Raise and lower the motor a couple of times to get the water out of there. And then open up all of the compartments and try to let it dry for a week if you can once you get home.
Boats stored in water may have mussels attached in hard-to-reach crevices. In those cases, McGarity encourages folks to reach out to Texas Parks and Wildlife for guidance. Draining boats, receptacles, and bait buckets before leaving or approaching public freshwater is mandatory under state law, and the fine for transporting prohibited aquatic invasive species in Texas is up to $500 per violation.
Preventing the spread of zebra mussels requires everyone doing their part, and the more folks take a few minutes to clean, drain, and dry their boats, the more we can slow the spread of this invasive species. They're already present in many of our lakes, but there are far more where they have not yet invaded. So let's all do our part and protect the lakes we love.
You can learn more about invasive species, their impact on Texas lakes, and instructions on cleaning, draining, and drying equipment at tpwd.texas.gov/stopinvasives. Those who have stored their boats in a body of water known to have invasive mussels can contact Texas Parks and Wildlife Department at 512-389-4848 for guidance on decontamination. In Lubbock, I'm Samantha Larned.
Democratic candidates running for state and federal offices stopped in Abilene this Monday on their South Plains swing tour. They spoke with voters about issues facing Texans ahead of the November election. KACU's Allison McCall has more.
Democratic supporters filed into a conference room in the Abilene Public Library South Branch. Eight candidates were sitting up front. With Texans set to elect statewide officials, state lawmakers, and members of Congress this November, candidates have been working to build support in communities across West Texas. So far, the eight candidates have traveled to Lubbock, Plainview, and Big Spring, with Abilene as their last stop on the South Plains swing tour. One of those candidates is Kyle Rabel, who's running to represent Texas's 19th congressional district in the U.S. House, a district that includes Abilene and parts of West Texas.
I think that Abilene gets looked over a little bit too much.
For Rabel, Abilene has been a regular stop on his campaign trail.
I started coming out to Abilene over a year ago before I even launched a campaign to learn more about Taylor County and Abileners. And I'm so excited to see how it's grown over the whole year that I've been running my race and see the amount of people and passion that is. And we need to keep that up because the future is so important.
Many of the candidates here have centered their campaigns on the same concerns: public education, affordability, healthcare, and the rapid growth of AI data centers across Texas. Some large data centers require millions of gallons of water per day for cooling, and their growth has raised questions about water availability in some Texas communities. State Representative Vicki Goodwin is the Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor. She says she's struck by how the issue of data centers is resonating with West Texas voters.
Nowadays, with the data centers and the huge, vast amounts of water that they use, people are really coming out. They're going to their city councils, county commissioner hearings, and now they're even signing petitions. And so I've been surprised at how important that issue has become.
Goodwin recently called on the governor to schedule a special legislative session to address what she calls the growing data center crisis. For attendees like Alexandra Garcia, the event was about finding community and becoming more involved locally.
I felt very supportive. I felt like I was able to find a community that I've been struggling to find in all my years here, and like that it's really now flourishing. It's really beautiful to see, especially the many faces that like consistently show up, and then like there's even new faces, you know, so it's a growing community and it's really nice.
Garcia, who's 24, says that sense of community is why she hopes more young adults get involved in local politics.
There's no better time than now. Like, stop waiting around until it gets like worse for you specifically. Like, it's nice to just build that up like with time, because like this is only really the beginning, it seems like.
Goodwin and the other candidates echoed that message, encouraging younger Texans to stay engaged.
The state level government has an impact on your daily life, whether it is through funding our schools, our education system, whether it is where you get your health care and that whole system, affordability, all of these things are impacted by legislators.
Whether Monday night's conversations will translate into votes won't be known until November 3rd, when Abilene residents can head to the polls. Regardless, Monday's event gave West Texans a chance to hear directly from Democratic candidates seeking some of the state's most influential offices. I'm Allison McCall in Abilene.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. By this time of year, many parts of Texas are usually showing the effects of long stretches of hot, sunny days. By July, ranchers and farmers often need to provide their livestock and crops with extra hydration, and some municipalities have to put watering restrictions in place for homeowners who want to fight the natural environment to create lush landscaping. But not this year. Last week's heavy rainstorms brought flooding to the central and southern portions of the state. Governor Abbott declared a state of emergency before the storms had even begun to cause damage. Even in the big country and other areas that didn't get the brunt of the storms,
the Texas Water
there's been notable impacts.
Water.
Mark Wenzel is a hydrologist with the organization and joins us by phone. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
First, how would you describe the importance of reservoirs to Texas?
Well, they're super important. You know, a reservoir is its basic function, saves up water in times of plenty so that you can use it during times of want. And that's really important in Texas, especially as you move to the west into central Texas and then farther west in Texas. East Texas gets lots of rainfall, so yeah, they're important over there, but they're really crucial for life itself in central and west Texas.
Can you give us an overview of how things looked for the state's water supplies before last week's storms?
Yeah, keep in mind that last week's storms, we haven't really seen all the moisture filter into our reservoirs yet. So, for example, on the Nueces Basin in South Texas, one of the more impacted by drought, reservoirs are quite low in that area. It's taken a while for those floodwaters to come down from the Edwards Escarpment, Uvalde County, and travel down to Choke Canyon Reservoir, Lake Corpus Christi, those reservoirs on the coast. And so they're actually not, today they're starting to see some uptick in their inflow to those reservoirs. So it'll take a while before the entire amount of volume that we got out of this this storm starts to make its way to all of our reservoirs. Hmm. But just taking a quick look at statewide, you know, early in the month, you know, we've really only had a bump of a few percentage points, and that's maybe 3% increase over the last few weeks, and that's, you know, up from 74% 3 months ago in April to now at 78% of capacity, and the last week's bump doesn't really look more than a half a percentage point or so. But for localized areas like South Texas with the Corpus Christi area, that bump is much more significant. For the Colorado River in the Austin area where I'm at, that bump is much more significant, filling Lake Travis for the first time in a few years. And so it really depends. It's localized in terms of how much the impact has been.
So the Texas Water Development Board produces several reports and updates web pages regularly with good information. You've got a page that has a lot of info on the state's, I believe, 122 reservoirs, if we counted correctly. It looks like if you draw a line down the center of Texas, the reservoirs to the east are full, while those on the western side are generally less so. Tell us about the reservoirs of West Texas.
Yeah, so that line that you noticed there from runs north to south, divides Texas east and west, pretty much runs on where our rainfall changes quite a bit in gradient. So to the east of that line, they get a lot more rainfall. It's a lot more regular in how it comes. And then it's a lot more sporadic to the west of that line. And the reservoirs behave differently because of that. Because they're constantly getting rainfall, those eastern reservoirs are closer to capacity more of the time. So it'd be pretty unusual for them to be down to 60% full. That would be a pretty severe drought on the eastern side of the state. On the western side of the state, our reservoirs are really designed to capture large, infrequent events and save that water for quite a long amount of time. So catching a storm every even 5 to 10 years, refilling the reservoir, and then gradually using that water over the course of the next 5 or 6 or 7 years. That would kind of be the game plan with our reservoirs to the west. So they can spend a lot of their time at 50% or less of capacity, but then when they fill up, you know, when there is a good event with a lot of volume, they want to capture it, be large enough to store a big chunk of that so they can use it later.
So specifically here in the Abilene area, as you know, we have a couple of reservoirs. The Fort Phantom Hill Reservoir is much more full than the Abilene Reservoir, about 76% compared to about 14%. Why are they so different?
So Lake Abilene has a much smaller drainage area. It's about 100 square miles. And then Fort Phantom Hill is downstream in the same system. And as you go downstream, you get more and more contributing area. It's got contributing area of several hundred square miles. And so it's kind of a statistics game then. If you've got a thunderstorm rolling through your area, which this time of year, that's how we get most of our precipitation is thunderstorms. They're not necessarily all that big. They're not going to cover the entire area around Abilene. But they're going to kind of come through and just kind of a swath across the land area. But when you're shooting to hit 100 square miles with a 100 square mile storm, say, your odds of hitting it are a lot less. So for the, it's almost just a statistics game, excuse me there. And you've got a bigger target when you're trying to hit the watershed for Lake Fort Phantom Hill. And so there have been enough storms that have crossed the watershed to kind of keep things up. And then Lake Abilene just has been a little bit unlucky here.
So we started by asking about the importance of reservoirs. As we look ahead to the future of the state, both environmentally and with increasing demand from new data centers, what role will reservoirs play in keeping water flowing?
Well, historically, reservoirs have been super important for Texas just to store up water in times of plenty so that we have it in times of want. And that is going to continue to be the case going into the future. We're going to have to be more and more efficient because we're not building a lot more reservoirs. As you can imagine, all the best sites for reservoirs were constructed early on in our history. And then over time, we've had to build them in less and less desirable and suitable places. And so at this point, there's probably not going to be a lot of new reservoirs built, and there'll be a lot more emphasis placed on using those existing reservoirs with better and better efficiency.
Well, in that case, Mark, what can West Texans do to help preserve these reservoirs?
That's a good question, and it's never a bad time to try to conserve water in Texas, whether we're in flood or drought. The next drought's always just around the corner. So conserve as much water as you can. A lot of times, the best way to do that is just in your choices for landscaping around your home. If you live in East Texas, Central Texas, or West Texas, pick some landscaping that's native to your area, something that's going to look good with the natural amount of precipitation, and that'll help you conserve as much water as you can for our state.
Mark Wenzel is a hydrologist with the Texas Water Development Board. Mark, thank you for your time.
You are so welcome, Nathan.
It's time for West Texas Roots. This story makes stops in Central Texas and even in a different continent, but follows the pattern of ending up in West Texas. Travis Smith recalls his childhood and his job in the Army during the Korean War. After his service was complete, he used the GI Bill to receive a master's degree, then worked as a school superintendent.
And my dad was trying to make a living on a farm and had four little kids. And my aunt saw the condition we were in, and she farmed us out to relatives. and I was the lucky one. I was 2 years old. I went to live with an uncle and aunt in Groesbeck, Texas. And my daddy didn't die until I'd been married for several years. Are you familiar with Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls? If you went straight across the highway from their main gate, you were at his grocery store. He lived in that store, and he ran that store. I visited him all the time. He went out in the summers. We never lost contact with each other, and with my other siblings either. They all made sure that we got together and didn't lose contact with each other. Later on, I had to go into the Korean War, and I was in the war for 2 years. I was in 6 months before the war was over, and I was in Korea at the time. My job was running a teletype, kind of like a telegraph. It was our main means of communication to the front at that time. And you typed on it like a typewriter, and that message came out at somebody else's machine, whoever you'd sent it. You put the name who he's going to, and then when you got through, you hit a button and it went to them. I was receiving and sending messages from the front line. I knew I was going to be drafted, and I had left one job looking for another one. It was more convenient at that time for me to volunteer. And I'm sure glad I did, because I sure got a bunch of good things in my life that I've been able to enjoy from having been in that service. I went through 12 hours more than a master's degree on GI Bill. It didn't cost me any tuition. No, I was married for 1 year. I was 18, my wife was 17, we got married. See, we just went to school 11 years. I was 17, I think she was 16, we got out of high school. That 12th year was added after we started in the first grade. And they just automatically moved everybody that was in school up a grade. I don't remember what grade I was in, probably sixth or seventh or something, and we skipped a grade, but it was just on paper. Kids were getting out of school too young, and they needed to be older when they got out of high school, and some of them were just barely 17. Everybody that started school that year went 12 years. I went on to become school superintendent, and my wife was my secretary in several different places in Texas. I retired in 59. The way the school calendar fell, I think I got 4 years credit out of 2 years of service on retirement. And my oldest daughter was in seven different schools before she graduated from high school. And it didn't hurt her any because she was dean of education at ACU. Lisa Reese, and her husband was dean of the Bible department.
Travis Smith's story of his role in the Korean War and how he used the benefits of his service to go to college was recorded at Lyndale Living Center. This is the West Texas Dispatch. The Abilene Zoo celebrated a major milestone this past weekend. Families packed the zoo for Zippity Zoo Day, a birthday celebration marking 60 years of connecting West Texans with wildlife. But beyond the cake and the many activities, the day became a celebration of memories generations of families have made along the way. KACU's Allison Diaz has more.
Wanda Renee Huber has been coming to the Abilene Zoo since the 1970s. Her favorite memories are from the lions exhibit.
My sister lives right over there at Canterbury Trails, and we used to come over here and we could hear them all the time. And They're just my favorite. I love them.
Today, she's watching the lemurs play, since the lion's habitat is undergoing a multi-million dollar rebuild. Also new, the Abilene Zoo welcomed an anteater to its grounds as part of the 60th birthday celebration.
I'm excited that it's its birthday.
The zoo pulled out all the stops to celebrate 60 years. Kids crafted birthday hats as giant bubbles floated overhead. Staff also handed out free cake and ice cream and offered plenty of up-close encounters with animals. For many, this day was about celebrating a place that's been part of their lives for decades. London Childress remembers special events like this from when she was a kid.
So I grew up coming to the zoo, doing these kind of things.
Childress is now the zoo's development manager.
So it's really fun to be on the other side to actually execute the events and create those community moments that I was so lucky to experience as a young girl.
Childress says creating those community experiences takes the entire zoo team.
So this is something we do annually, so we have some of our trademark elements, but we want it to feel a little bit more special than every other year just because it's such a big birthday. Every team kind of assists and builds what they're good at, and it creates a really cohesive and wonderful celebration for the guests to enjoy.
Since opening its gates in 1966, the Abilene Zoo has welcomed generations of West Texas families, growing alongside the community while introducing visitors to wildlife from around the world. During one of the day's animal encounters, families gathered in the Red Oak Plaza as volunteers held a boa constrictor, a blue-tongued skink, and a baby armadillo. Children reached out to touch the animals, while animal ambassador keeper Crystal Hunt answered questions and shared facts about each species. For Hunt, those moments come full circle.
I've lived here pretty much my whole life. Came to the zoo since I was really tiny, tiny, and now I get to do the same thing with my son. So,
at the zoo, making memories is always about the animals.
What's your favorite animal you've seen today?
Giraffe.
I like the sloth bear.
Giraffes. I like capybaras and giraffes.
Yeah. The crocodile?
Yeah.
A sea turtle?
Is. Giraffe.
The fish.
And the crocodile.
The bears.
The bears?
My favorite animal is that crocodile.
Okay. Alligator, Bubba.
I want the alligator.
As the afternoon wound down, families crowded around the alligator exhibit. Children squeezed up to the fence, waiting for feeding time. Before Albert the Alligator's birthday feeding, visitors sang happy birthday to both the Abilene Zoo and one of its longest residents, the alligator who's lived there since 1966.
Ready, set, let's go!
Happy birthday to you! Happy birthday to you! Happy birthday!
When the singing stopped, families scattered across the zoo once again. Some added to memories stretching back decades. Others left with new ones they had just begun to make. 60 years after opening its gates, the Abilene Zoo continues to connect generations of West Texans, not just through the animals they come to see, but also the moments they share together. I'm Allison Diaz in Abilene.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. We are so glad you've spent the hour with us. If you haven't already done so, subscribe to the podcast and check out the West Texas Dispatch even when you're on vacation. It's available wherever you get your podcasts, as well as on KACU.org and the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, and producers Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger. Calvin Claiborne is our digital editor. Special thanks to J.C. Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm Nathan Sanders.